Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center, conversations and commentary featuring scholars and visitors at the center. This is Wayne Pond. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life. Welcome to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. Representations of Evil in American Culture, this week on Soundings. My guest is Andrew Del Banco, a professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. Andrew Del Banco's books include The Puritan Ordeal, published by Harvard University Press. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Andrew Del Banco is working on a project entitled Representations of Evil in American Culture. Here is Andrew Del Banco.
I think it's fair to say that those of us who grew up in the 1950s in this country had a kind of residual cloud of the Second World War hanging over us. In my case, it was perhaps a little denser than for others, since my parents were German Jews who fled Hitler in the 1930s. And I grew up hearing a good deal about Nazism and seeing the images of Nazism, as we all did in the movies, and reading about it to some extent. And I remember my mother speaking to me about Dr. Goebbels as Mephistopheles incarnate. Mm-hmm. And so there's a way in which this impossible to understand phenomenon of European civilization going mad and becoming barbarous and brutal, in fact the nation that was by some measures the most civilized in Europe, came to me very early and has stayed with me ever since. As for why America, there again, I think the answer is partly personal, and that is that all of us who study American literature and culture are in some ways obsessed with ourselves and the country that we call our own, with varying degrees of pleasure or displeasure. But also, more objectively, I think there are ways in which the problem of evil as it impinges on American culture has a kind of unique bearing. What I mean by that is that America is a kind of living embodiment of what we call modernity. Mm-hmm. It's the most, it's the world's most modern country in many ways that I think we could agree upon.
And self-consciously so.
Self-consciously so. And so, if we think, as I do, that thinking about evil is particularly difficult in the modern world, then I think it makes sense to examine the way in which Americans have or have not been able to think and talk about it.
All right. Well, a number of questions come to mind, Andy Del Banco. You say that it's difficult for Americans to think of evil. Is that because we live in a society of the rational and the scientific, everything that on its surface does not appear to be what the supernatural, the other world? You've written a book, for instance, about Puritanism, about people who believed in the palpability of that world. Yet today we don't live in that kind of society. Why is it difficult for us to talk to ourselves about what we call evil?
Well, I think that's a very basic question, one which I'm wrestling with in this project. I think there, in almost any way that one can approach the problem, I think one immediately sees that the traditional ways that at least Westerners have had for thinking and talking about evil are increasingly unavailable to us.
You mean a vocabulary, the terms that we're going to use? You're not talking about the nature of the thing itself.
That's right. I mean, take, for instance, the image of Satan himself, uh-huh. which has been one way to turn into an image or into a figure that one can identify and describe and understand the features of. The whole thrust of the modern world, with its empirical temper and its sense of skepticism toward what my Puritan friends called the invisible world, mm-hmm. Makes it, you're a crackpot if you believe in such a thing as Satan or Satanism.
Yeah. Like astrology.
That's right. But I think the problem goes deeper than that. There's a way in which the concept of Satan, which is a very interesting concept to follow in its development throughout the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance and the age of what we call Enlightenment, is really a concept that involves the idea of disguise, blurred boundaries. He's a figure who's not quite clear whether he's beast or human, sometimes not quite clear whether he has any gender at all, or whether mm-hmm. he's in some ways both genders.
He is other. He is not us.
Yes, he is. He's a disruptor of stabilities. Mm-hmm. He's a prankster in a very fundamental and threatening way. And there's a way, as I think about this issue, I find myself more and more coming to the view that Satan himself is a kind of figure of modernity. That is, all the features that I've just described, one could apply to a description of what modern life is all about.
Well, I remember one description of one of the Nazi war criminals. I'm not sure which one it was. Somebody calling him, maybe it was Dr. Goebbels, a creature of the void. Now, if that's modernity, we're in trouble.
Well, exactly, and I think the current atmosphere of intellectual life in this country is such that the closest thing to evil in the minds of many intellectuals nowadays is precisely the opposite of what it used to be. That is, the evil impulse is the impulse to totalize, or to say that we or I have a grasp on the transcendent, or I know the right way, or I am in communication with an idea or a spirit that is larger than the present moment, which is a very different concept of the nature of evil than what has been traditional.
Well, you would be talking, what, about the interplay between absolutism and relativism, pluralism, all the... I guess you're headed, what, toward figuring out how our ethnicities play into the notion of diversities in culture. Is that what you're after?
Well, yes, in part. I think, for instance, you began with the question of why is it difficult for Americans to think about this problem. One reason, I think, is that given the pluralism of this culture, it has always been, and I think mostly this has been a good thing, it has always been rather more difficult for us to comfortably identify that other than it might be for more homogeneous societies. Mm-hmm. We are, after all, always incorporating others into ourselves. And we are a culture that believes, at least officially, that to be an American is not to belong to a particular racial group or a particular blood lineage, but to make a kind of free will choice or an act of consent. And within those categories, it's rather more difficult, I think, to point and say, there is Satan in mm-hmm. human form. It happens, of course, from time to time. It happens with horrible virulence at certain times in American history, but on balance, I think rather less than it has happened in most Western cultures.
Let's talk for a couple of moments, Andy Del Banco, about what you call the reigning metaphors that Americans have employed to discuss evil, to talk to themselves about evil. I think of the middle of the 19th century, the Civil War, the enormity of slavery.
Well, let's talk about the middle of the 19th century and the crisis of the Civil War for a moment. At the moment that the nation split apart, it became attractive, both politically and psychologically and in many other ways, to describe the world as broken into halves of virtue and vice from both the Southern and the Northern point of view. For the Southerner, it was the Northern industrialist with his greed and his appetite for land and his disrespect for traditional values and so on. For the Northerner, it was the Simon Legree figure, the slave-driving brute who was prostituting the original ideals of the Republic. And standing in the midst of this sort of national internal debate was the great figure, of course, of Lincoln. Lincoln seems to me to be a kind of paradigmatic instance of the serious intellectual who, alas, ever since Lincoln's day, has hardly touched the political sphere, who wrestled with this problem, that is, how to talk about evil as a reality and come to terms with it and face up to it. And he believed very deeply in the evil of slavery. He talked about how much he hated slavery in much the way, say, that Captain Ahab speaks of hating the white whale, not very long before Lincoln's presidency. And yet, the remarkable thing about Lincoln, and the reason why I find still today that the Gettysburg Address remains a kind of scriptural document for me, and I think should for many Americans, is that he almost never demonizes the other party.
He doesn't create other, as you're in reference to what we were saying a moment ago.
That's right. If you look at the Gettysburg Address, particularly in connection, in the context of the other speeches that were delivered that day at the battlefield, it's quite remarkable to notice that Lincoln never once mentions the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly doesn't offer dark and foreboding images of that enemy. So in other words, Lincoln was, I think one could put it this way, Lincoln was tapping into one tradition that has been terribly important in Christian history, and that is the tradition of thinking of the world as a monistic entity, and thinking of evil as a falling away from the possibility of transcendence, and urging in a kind of beckoning, hortatory language, that his fellow citizens come back to the truth rather than aligning them with the party of Satan.
You make me think, apropos of this discussion of Lincoln and slavery and representations of evil, there's a wonderful line in Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn. He describes this little 14-year-old boy and says, "Here's an instance of a sound heart and a deformed conscience."
Yeah. Well, you know, to read Huckleberry Finn today is still, I think, to be very much moved. But it's also to recognize that Twain fundamentally was a romantic, in the sense that
what, people are basically good, you mean? What?
Yes, in the sense that with all his his bitter realism about the nature of culture and society.
And particularly at the end of his life.
Yes. But nevertheless, the beauty of Huckleberry Finn is that this is an account essentially of what would have been called a century or two earlier a conversion experience.
Uh-huh.
It's an account of Huck Finn coming to terms with his own limitations as he faces the fact that there's a part of him that hasn't accepted Jim as a human being on the raft.
And are the limitations the evil? Is that it?
I think so for Twain, and I think the ambiguity of that book, which so many readers have had trouble with, is that Huck seems to come to recognize those limitations at a certain moment when he's separated in the fog from Jim on the raft, but that toward the end of the book he falls away from that recognition again.
Mm-hmm.
My point that reading Twain is to read to hear a voice from the past. Is that it's difficult for us to believe this anymore, I think. We live in a time where we're not comfortable speaking about the essential goodness, or in fact the essential anythingness of the self. The operative word in contemporary academic discourse nowadays is not the self anymore, but the subject.
Hmm.
That is, the notion that we make a mistake when we think of the self as an autonomous entity that can act as a free agent in the world, but rather we are subjects of the language of our culture. And as soon as we begin to think that way, and I think it's not just academics who think that way, the whole notion of responsibility becomes very difficult to hold on to.
Human agency.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
The religious origins of this culture are, of course, in a rather hard-headed Protestantism that believed very deeply in the concept of original sin. But the story of religious history in this country, as far as I can understand it at least, is the story of the sort of diminution of that tradition, kind of unraveling of that tradition. You get reawakenings of it from time to time, even in the 20th century, in a figure like Reinhold Niebuhr, who spoke after the Second World War, during the war, very eloquently about sin. But by and large, religion has become sort of watered down, a kind of liberal, self-cultivating creed is what I think one finds. On the other hand, religion remains terribly important at a kind of visceral level in American life.
I believe in something, huh?
yeah, though one finds the religious impulse as it expresses itself in contemporary evangelicalism, for instance, to be in some ways a rather backward looking impulse. I mean, if there's ever anywhere in our culture where the old idea of providence, that mm-hmm. is the old idea that our lives are governed by a rational spirit, which we may not be able to understand, but to which we owe allegiance.
It's in the fundamentalists, the evangelicals.
It's in the fundamentalists. Right. But how does that issue forth in contemporary life? Well, it issues forth, for instance, in the notion that those members of our society who suffer from a disease like AIDS are somehow being punished.
Yeah, this is the vengeance of God.
Right, which is a concept that in the 17th century would have been entirely conventional, and in the 20th century seems like a kind of medieval superstition.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a couple of minutes, Andy Del Banco, about the organization of your study of representations of evil. Are there particular methodological concerns, what standards by which you judge your evidence and organize it that are what you're happy about or that you're troubled about at this point in this project?
Well, there are many concerns of many types, and I'm still at an early stage of thinking about these issues, so I'm hoping they'll be resolved sooner or later. My training is really as a student of literature, and so I tend to begin with those texts that we regard as written at a sort of fever pitch of creative intelligence, and books like Melville's novels and Hawthorne's fictions seem to me still to cast a particularly illuminating light on these issues. However, to move from those texts to making some general statements about what Americans in general, if one can speak that way, think and feel at any given moment in history is very difficult. Hmm. The great mass of men and women, even in the modern period, don't write down their convictions. So one has to approach them indirectly through a variety of sources that I'm trying to work with. Essentially, in the end, I think one falls back on one's own instincts. And
where does that take you?
Well, it takes me to the library where where I find myself reading texts, and there's always a certain pleasure in reading texts that one has the feeling nobody has read lately, that address the same issues as the major writers are dealing with, but in a rather different way. For instance, let me give you a couple of examples. Here is this is a document by a southern gambler, in fact, who wrote a confessional autobiography about his life as a gambler, and he tells a little story in the 1820s about his childhood, which is very resonant for me. He says, "One day, my eldest sister ordered me to go to the spring and bring some water, which command I refused and told her to go herself. She struck me, and I cursed her, upon which she told my mother, who gave me a severe whipping and made me go to the spring quickly. I cried very much, and on the way I thought the sky opened and I saw the heavens. I saw that good man. I fell on the ground and thought I heard something say, 'You shan't come here. If you are a bad boy, you must go to hell.' The heavens closed, and I saw what I always shall remember, a great black something in the shape of a man with horns on his head and with a loud voice saying, 'I will catch you.' I screamed and cried and instantly returned without the water. My mother was going to whip me again. I fell on my knees and begged if she would go with me, I would show her and sister. They both went with me, but we saw nothing. It was just about sunset. My mother and sister both said they would forgive me, that it was the effect of some fright that had been revived in my imagination upon reflecting that I had done something wrong."
Well, what should we think of Andy Del Banco? Bernadette at Lourdes, William Blake, Joseph Smith. There are lots of ways to play that particular, tease that thread out as a representation of evil.
Right. Well, what it makes me think is that here is a man who has grown up in a culture that is poised on the edge of modernity. Mm-hmm. That is, it's clear that he has been educated to believe in Satan, that he has an image of Satan in his mind, and that when he acts in such a way as to induce feelings of what we would call guilt nowadays, he actually sees Satan. But then what happens when he returns to fearfully to his mother is that she, in effect, absolves him of this fear. And reassures him that this is just a product of his imagination.
Early psychotherapy.
Something like that. So what you see here, I think, is Satan turning before your eyes as you read this document, Satan turning into a metaphor. And that's a fairly decent way, I think, of describing our cultural history.
Speaking of metaphors, Andy DelBanco, what do you make of contemporary American popular culture with respect to representations of evil? We got Arnold Schwarzenegger playing the Terminator. We got Freddy, whatever his last name is, the slasher movies, that sort of thing. Are those, not to trivialize your topic, do they, in some form or another, become evidence for these emblems of evil in our society?
Well, yes, and I find myself paying a fair amount of attention, in fact, to what we call popular culture. One has to be careful because you're never quite sure what the popular books and what the classics will be in years to come. There's some rather classy horror fiction being written in this country at the moment, which sells by the millions in the supermarkets and the paperback exchange shops.
Stephen King, for example?
Stephen King and other writers who I find even more compelling than Stephen King, like a writer named Thomas Harris.
Oh, yeah. Oh, The Silence of the Lambs and Red Dragon. Right. Oh, my goodness.
Precisely. And I think these writers, in fact, and it seems to me to have something to do with why they sell so widely, have their finger on the pulse in a way that's worth our paying attention to.
But don't those books speak to our fears rather than our conceptions of evil, or are they the same thing?
I think they speak to both. I mean, take, for instance, Peter Blatty's famous or infamous book, The Exorcist. Uh-huh. Now, here is a writer who clearly finds the categories through which we think about certain mental phenomena to be inadequate. I think he understands that psychoanalysis has sort of stepped into the place that religion used to occupy, and that it raises all kinds of problems of the sort that we've been discussing. Who's responsible for your behavior? One might say, for instance, that in the end of the 17th century, when the witchcraft craze developed in Salem, that the Puritan persecutors were really saying that someone else is responsible for your unconscious. If you're behaving in ways that are intolerable to the society, you go out and you find the reason why, and the reason why is some disreputable woman down the street.
Either that or they were trying to take control of that subconsciousness. They were exercising a political or an ideological oppression upon these people in order... I mean, it has been argued that the Salem witch trials were political trials, essentially.
Yeah, I'm more inclined to think that they were sort of the last gasp of a worldview that allowed you to think in the way that I've just described.
Uh-huh.
But in any case, we've moved very far from that. We've moved to the point now where it's not quite clear who's responsible for one's unconscious. And if you read these murder novels, true crime novels as well as fictional accounts, you come face to face with this problem. I mean, for instance, reading in one of these recently, I came across the statement that a recent study in England of murderers shows that fully 60% are convincingly amnesic for the event.
They lose control of this whatever it is inside of them.
That's
they
right.
surrender.
Well, more than that, in many cases, they simply don't remember.
Uh-huh.
And so when you're up against that proposition, the polygraph test doesn't work, that the conventions of testimony and confession don't work, you're facing the whole question of who's responsible. If this person doesn't even remember, if the act was committed in a drug-crazed moment,
yeah,
or because of cruelty in your childhood, who's responsible? And I think a writer like Blatty, whom we finally get back to here, is in touch with this problem rather crudely, I think, and certainly doesn't resolve it, but he's in touch with it, and what he does is he sort of re-invokes the old medieval image of Satan himself, and he brings an exorcist onto the stage, and mm-hmm. he starts talking about these phenomena in an old and degraded language. So I take these kinds of fictions quite seriously, and I think students of our culture ought to.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Andy Delbacco. We're talking about your study of what you term the reigning metaphors, representations of evil in American society. Do Americans today in the 1990s, what is our vocabulary like when we talk about evil, when we're not gonna explain it, I suppose, or define it, but when we talk to ourselves about it, how do we talk these days?
I think, and one reason why I feel a certain urgency in this project, is that I think our vocabulary is very impoverished, and that our efforts to address the problem, which no one can escape in their own lives, are oftentimes very dangerous. We've seen recently the efforts of our president to liken Saddam Hussein to Adolf Hitler, and although there may be some points of connection, there are at least as many points of difference.
Mm-hmm. Reagan called the Russians an evil empire.
Right. Reagan called the Russians an evil empire, and now the chief officer of that empire is awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, as he richly deserves. So our vocabulary for talking about evil has been thrown into very considerable confusion. And what concerns me, and I think should concern any thoughtful American, is that when that happens, it's very likely that we will come up with some vivid and lively substitute for our previous targets. And except for figures like Lincoln, there are not very many public men in the history of the Republic who have been able to avoid that kind of resort. So I think it's a terribly important moment in American cultural history, indeed in world history, in this connection. And I guess I hope that I can do my small part in making us a little more self-conscious about how we think about these issues.
Andrew Delbanco teaches at Columbia University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During a fellowship year at the center, Andrew Delbanco is working on a study entitled Representations of Evil in American Culture. Soundings is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding discussion, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 544. That's program number 544. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, part one in a series of discussions about science and American society. Over the next 2 weeks, you'll hear from Robert McCormick Adams, Secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, Presidential Science Advisor Alan Bromley, Rita Colwell of the Maryland Biotechnology Institute, Governor James G. Martin of the state of North Carolina, and Congressman David Price of North Carolina's 4th District. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Representations of Evil in American Culture, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for a conversation with Andrew Delbanco of Columbia University. Andrew Delbanco is working on a study entitled Representations of Evil in American Culture. From high art to low, from the Puritans to Freddy Krueger, Representations of Evil in American Culture. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.